The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Good evening, and welcome to this, your worst nightmare.
The following program is a podcast1.com production.
He's a world champion wrestler, best-selling author, actor, and lead singer of Fozzy. Now he's rocking the podcast world. This is Talk Is Jericho. Talk Is Jericho, starring Chris Jericho.
Welcome to Talk Is Jericho, the Pot of Thunder and Rock and Roll. That's right, and it's Halloween. It's Eek Week. Right here on TIJ, the remedy for boredom has arrived. The People's Podcast is here. Let's go for a ride.
Franken Chicken, he's a bad mother clucker. Franken Chicken, bark, bark. Franken Chicken, he's a bad mother clucker. Franken Chicken, bark, bark. Franken Chicken, he's a bad mother clucker. Franken Chicken, bark, bark. Franken Chicken, he's a bad mother clucker. Franken Chicken, bark, bark.
The terror sweeps across the land, insanity permeating every pore. Beware of the lunacy known as the Franken Chicken. Yeah. I've been singing that to Corey Taylor all week long after he started talking about the Franken Chicken that he saw at the Freak Show Wrestling in Las Vegas. One of my favorite things ever. Franken Chicken. So amazing. Another one of my favorite things, Halloween and horror movies. And this guy, actually both these guys, have made some classic horror movies. Troma Films founder Lloyd Kaufman, the man who created and was behind the movies Toxic Avenger, Nuke 'Em High, Redneck Zombies, Sergeant Kabuki Man, Tromeo and Juliet, Terror Firmer, and of course Blood-Sucking Freaks, featuring Ralphus, the murderous little person, or as Hornswoggle would say, the murderous midget, where I got the name for my sidekick in WCW. Lloyd has made so many amazing movies with almost no budget, and he's world famous for it, and has influenced so many amazing filmmakers, from Tarantino to Eli Roth. We'll talk more about Eli in a little bit. We'll find out how Lloyd makes his movies, plus we'll find out who he went to Yale with. George W. Bush? Yeah. He made his first movie with his childhood friend, Oliver Stone. Does he still talk to either? Plus, Lloyd started the careers of Kevin Costner, Samuel L. Jackson, so many other huge A-list Hollywood stars. Plus, Lloyd might be one of the only extras to be in the credits of two Rocky films and Guardians of the Galaxy. We got lots coming up with Lloyd Kaufman. What a great guy. So much fun. Plus, speaking of fun and a great guy, Eli Roth is coming back as well to discuss his favorite horror films of all time, what's going on with Green Inferno, what projects he's working on now, and the sensation that's sweeping the nation, hashtag 6 Second Scare. It is such a great idea. You got to go on Twitter and Vine and check out all of the 6 Second mini horror movies that are up there right now competing for the grand prize. I'm in it. Chop Chop Son is the name of my 6 Second Scare. Go check it out right now. And also, go check out my link on podcast1.com for Amazon. Thank you so much for supporting this show. You know you can do that even more by going to Amazon and buying whatever you want, because they're a proud sponsor of Talk Is Jericho. And every time you shop on Amazon through one of my links, Amazon gives a small percentage of your purchase back to the show to help us cover production costs. I got links for Amazon USA, Amazon UK, and Amazon Canada. Just go to podcast1.com, click on the Keep Our Podcasts Free free banner at the top of the page, then hit the Talk is Jericho button. You get all kinds of cool stuff on Amazon, like, for instance, the new Fozzy record, Do You Want to Start a War? My new best-selling book, The Best in the World at What? I have no idea. Have you got it yet? Have you checked it out? What are you waiting for? People are raving that it's their favorite book of the three that I've done, just like they're raving that the Fozzy record, Do You Want to Start a War? Is our best. Thank you so much if you've bought it, and if you haven't, what are you waiting for? Plus, you can also pick up one of Lloyd Kaufman's Troma film movies on DVD. Like I said, Toxic Avenger 1 through 5. That's a great one. Terra Firma, one of my all-time favorite Troma movies. Also, Tromeo and Juliet is amazing as well. You might want to start with those if you're looking for a Lloyd Kaufman film to begin with. Or how about an Eli Roth movie? Hostel, Cabin Fever, Hostel 2, maybe Inglourious Basterds. He played the Bear Jew in that movie. Eli has done so many things, and there's so many things you can buy at Amazon. Truth is, whatever you want. You want to buy TV, you want to buy a computer, anything, a desk, a microphone, anything you want to get. And if you use my link, it won't cost you anything extra. No hidden fees or charges. So if you happen to be doing some Amazon shopping, you can help out the show in the process. Just go to podcastone.com. Click on the Keep Our Podcasts Free banner at the top of the page. Then hit the Talk is Jericho button. Bookmark it so you can get to these links in one easy click. And keep supporting the show. Thank you so much. All right. Mentioned, Do You Want to Start a War? Fozzy currently off the road, but we're getting back on the horse again. Cinderblock Party Tour with Texas Hippie Coalition and Shaman's Harvest starts November 20th at the Machine Shop in Flint, Michigan, going all the way into December, ending December 12th in St. Pete, Florida. And then we're taking it overseas. The Cinderblock Party World Tour 2015 with the Dirty Youth starts March 4th in Belfast, Ireland, goes all the way to March. Well, who knows? We're still booking dates at this point. Go to FozzyRock.com to see all of the dates and all VIP package information. England, Ireland, Scotland, overseas, and that's just the beginning of that. So come on down, check us out. Plus, don't forget, November, just a few weeks from now, 10th through the 15th, I will be back with the WWE for just a short period of time. 4 shows in England, 2 in Germany. If you're going to be there, I'm excited to see you. Go to Facebook, Chris Jericho, to find out all that information. All right, Lloyd Kaufman is coming up. But right now we're going to kick off Eek Week with my good friend, the very talented and sexy Eli Roth.
People go missing around here. They're gone for good.
All right, here to discuss his favorite horror movies, my old friend Eli Roth from Location. What's up, my man?
How are you, dude? I'm trying to show up on time for you this time.
I was laughing. I'm still envisioning you wearing like a disheveled tuxedo.
Stumbling in from all-night Oscar parties. And by the way, now I feel like I have to appear that way at all times around you.
Yeah, I was almost envisioning like, that's your director's outfit. Like you wear a tuxedo with the bow tie, but it's not tied up. It's kind of just hanging around your neck. You're like, we got to get this shot, see? Okay,
hey,
zoom in on the close-up.
Hey, snap to it, see? No, my new look, I'm going to look like Dudley Moore and Arthur, just like stumbling around drunk in a tuxedo, maybe about the top hat, the new dress. So.
With the cigarette in the holder.
Exactly.
So you're calling from Location. I know it's kind of a secret project. I've been following you, as I always do. You mentioned that you're filming some stuff.
Yeah.
Is it a secret project?
No, this one is out in the open. It's called South of Hell. It's a brand new series that I'm doing with Jason Blum from Blumhouse, who did Ouija just open this weekend.
Oh, okay.
And Paranormal. So this is one of his first TV projects, and it's with Jim Manos, who's the creator of Dexter. They brought me this great script with it's about a woman who fights demons and possession. It's exorcism themed, and we got Mina Suvari in the lead. So we just finished our first week of shooting, and it went awesome. I did some really, really insane stuff that I've never gotten to do before. So I'm excited. I think it's going to be really fun.
Are you directing?
Yeah, I'm directing the first episode, but the other directors are Jennifer Lynch.
Mm-hmm.
We got Ty West, of course, The Sacrament, House of the Devil. Ty's going to direct one. Jeremiah Chechik, Rachel Talalay, who did Nightmare on Elm Street 5. So, really, we've got a really fun group. And the script is great and awesome cast. So, we're having a good time.
It seems that, like, after a few years of doing other things, still obviously very much involved in a lot of Hollywood's things and a lot of great projects, you're now kind of getting back into the director's chair and really kind of going back to your horror roots after a few years of kind of doing some other things.
Well, you know, it's weird how we can't escape our taste. Like, no matter what you do, you're always going to love wrestling and heavy metal and rock and horror. Like, we can think we're going to outgrow them or mature, but they just suddenly, it just gets, it's almost like it gets, it's a condition that gets worse.
Right.
You know, but it, the truth is, like, you can't control what you like. And I look for other stuff. The movie that I just, the movie that I directed with Keanu Reeves, that I'm doing the sound and music on it now, Knock Knock, is a thriller. And then the script comes along in a great project, and I came on as an executive producer. And I thought, you know what, it'd be awesome to have another TV series going that if it's a hit and it does well and keeps going for years, I'll always have something where I can always jump in and direct an episode, you know?
Right, well, that's what you do with Hemlock Grove, because that just did its third season, and that's the last season, right?
Yeah, their writers are cracking the stories for it right now, but it's going to be the final season. So we got that. So hopefully if this one does well, it'll keep going. There's no air date or anything yet, but we're doing 8 episodes.
You are working on it. No, what's going on with Green Inferno? I know there's been some issues with the distribution. And talk about the movie that everybody is waiting to see. I've seen the trailer. It looks amazing. Is there some holdups with that? Is it legal stuff?
Yeah, it's a legal stuff. It's a weird situation that and not only have I never been in, it's one that a lot of people, even in the industry, are like, wow, this is a new one. The CEO of this company, Worldview Entertainment, got fired, and they were going to pay part of the advertising spend, and there was like a big kind of legal rift between Worldview and Open Road, the distributor, because it's like, for a lot of messy reasons, we can see who's wrong, and it's sort of no one's fault, but it's a whole culmination of things. But it's basically a bunch of lawyers are all trying to work it out. So this is what it is. And it's just a slow process, and it's really frustrating because we can't pick a release date. We don't know what's going to happen. And I don't have the answers either, other than every day I'm checking in, and they're like, okay, we have a call set for Tuesday. This was, you know, push. All right, Friday we're going to talk. Okay, we had a great call. They're going to send over their return, all that kind of stuff. And it's just been dragging on. And apparently this company has several other movies that are caught in this similar situation. So it sucks. The thing is that's cool is we're going to do it in 4DX for the international release. There's one theater in the U.S. that does this now where the seats move and there's like wind blowing and air and water sprays on you. I know when you come to Los Angeles, I went to the 4DX tester room and I saw how the 4DX version of Green Inferno. And it's like when the camera's flying over the jungle, the seats tip forward and you get wind in your face and your stomach really turns. It's really one of the craziest, most fun experiences. So when the movie, I kind of feel like there'll be more 4DX theaters built by the time the movie gets released. But everyone's pushing to get it out as soon as possible. It's not going to be out in 2014 for sure. It's kind of given up hope on that, but 2015. But it's just like lawyers and letters and emails. So all I can do is just keep moving forward, man.
Exactly.
Finish Knock Knock, Shooting Stuff of Hell, writing other stuff, and you know, I can't dwell on it.
You got to create destinies, man. That's what you got to do.
I got people building scarecrows. I got to give them destinies. I think of you in Halloween. You know, I don't know if people know that we're huge fans of the documentary American Movie with Mark Borchardt, and opens on Halloween. We use people building scarecrows.
That's right. Yeah, in black and white.
Black and white.
That's why I wanted to have you on, though. It's Halloween week, and later on the show today, I have Lloyd Kaufman on, one of the greatest. Horror movie filmmakers, kind of B-movie filmmakers. Actually, you and I became friends years ago because of our mutual love of heavy metal, wrestling, horror, etc. I wanted to talk to you about some of your favorite horror movies of all time. And I know you go beyond just like, oh, I love Halloween, and I love, you know, Friday the 13th. I mean, you know every movie, and you've turned me on to so many great ones. I wanted to kind of go through a few of them with you and see what's kind of like, if you had to kind of put together a list of some of your favorite horror movies that maybe some of my listeners can watch over the next few days, where do you even start?
Definitely. Well, you know, there's the classics. The thing is, it's funny how Texas Chainsaw Massacre, for me, which is a classic, to a 20-year-old kid today might be boring.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certain movies that transcend that. I think The Shining definitely transcends that. The first Nightmare on Elm Street, which terrified me, now people watch it and they see a young Johnny Depp, and they're looking
right.
at the, you know, the Scott Baio socks and the feathered hair. I feel like horror movies have to be judged on how scared you were the very first time you saw it, because people will always do this thing where they're like, oh, you know, I rewatched The Ring. It's not really that scary.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, like, with a comedy, you can have a movie like Anchorman or Slapshot, and the more you watch it, the funnier it gets. But horror, the power of it is that you don't know what's going to happen, and that anticipation, that potency is the very thing that you lose every time you watch it more and more and more. So, of course, as it as you watch a movie like Night of the Creeps for the 75th time, you just love the fact that in the bathroom stall it says Striper, like written on one of the stalls right before the kid gets killed. So then you go in your high school and you write Striper in the same stall in the same place because there'll be some other Night of the Creeps fan. Like, it's those little weird things that make the movie for you. So I would say, but these are some movies that are like timeless classics.
Do you remember in Sleepaway Camp 2 when they do the reveal and they go and they see all the dead bodies in the cabin and there's like dead body and there's dead leech girl and then right in the middle there's a Flotsam and Jetsam album cover for no apparent reason right in the middle of the shot.
And you know what's funny is I talked to Fred Decker, director of Night of the Creeps, and he's like, yeah, my art director, like her boyfriend was, the girl was the set decorator, her boyfriend was in Striper, was a bass player.
No kidding.
She said it's a shout out to him. No. Totally. There's actually a Striper connection between the art director. She's like, I'll just give a shout-out to my boyfriend's band. And yet, that's the thing that everybody's like, did you see Night of the Creeps? Yeah, Striper. Like, it's the weirdest
thing.
It's
right.
So I love that kind of stuff. You know, I think that The Ring is great. You know, The Ring, the original Japanese one, and the remake with Naomi Watts. I rewatched it recently. It's no accident that movie was such a hit. It's just very creepy. It's full of creep and menace. It scared Gore Verbinski, of course, went on to do all the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. Really, it's a great movie. You know, and I think people knock it because it was a remake, but that movie is one of my favorites. I think John Carpenter's The Thing is a classic. It's one of those movies as a kid. Now you look back and there's no women in the movie. It's just all dudes. It's
very right.
Like a macho testosterone movie, kind of like the way Reservoir Dogs is.
Let me ask you this. What do you think happened at the end? Do you think, because when it's just Kurt Russell and Keith Scott?
David Keith.
Keith David.
Keith David.
That's the one. Do you think that one of them was the thing at that point?
I mean, I've heard different things. I've heard different theories. I mean, now Carpenter's like, oh, they were both things. But I wouldn't believe that. I can't believe that they're both things. I mean, I want to believe that they're both human.
Right.
But I don't know. It's something I've been arguing since fifth grade. We've been arguing about whether
such a great ending too. And I remember like you made a great point earlier about how the secret to horror movies is you don't know what's going to come next. And when they're kind of doing the heart paddles and the whole body cavity opens into the giant mouth.
Just amazing.
One of the most creepiest things, along with the head turning into a spider. You don't forget stuff like that.
No, that opening scene when they do the blood test, just the scalpel against the thumb. And Rob Bottin is a wizard at special effects. He was like 19 or 20 when he did that.
Wow.
Just amazing, amazing, amazing. And it was so over the top, and it's interesting how that for that movie they called John Carpenter, quote, a pornographer of violence.
Wow.
That was what the critics called him, and that's why he made Starman after, which was a comedy.
Because really?
He was so tired. Yeah, it's like when Raimi made Evil Dead. Now, the first Evil Dead is a classic.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it would be as scary to people, but it's great to think that Sam Raimi made that at 21 with $350,000.
That's
like
insane.
A year doing it. Broke Bruce Campbell's tooth driving. He put the camera on the motorcycle and ran it through the woods. They call that the Raimi cam. But a lot of that stuff is sort of Three Stooges camera work Sam Raimi invented.
That's how he did it with a motorcycle? Because you know what you're talking about, that shot through the woods where it's like...
Yep. That's he just put it on it like a moped, like a dirt bike, and ran it through the woods. Yeah, like a BMX. And it actually went into Bruce Campbell's mouth and broke his tooth.
No kidding.
That's how great that movie is.
Wow.
So It's Evil Dead's a classic. I love, this is a great sleepover movie. Like, after you've watched The Ring or a really scary movie, The Thing, I think when you're with your friends and it's at, like, 11:30 at night or 12:15, like, that sort of 1 to 3 a.m. movie, you can't beat Pieces. Pieces is, like, a perfect chainsaw slasher movie. And it's interesting watching it now. It's from 1981 or 1982. Juan Picar Simón, the director, he's a Spanish director, but the producer, Steve Manazian, was from Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
So there are all these like random Massachusetts town, like Natick and let's say like Dedham ambulances. I was like, why are there Danvers? Like they're very strange, subtle references to Massachusetts. and it's such a fun movie. Like, it doesn't stop. The kills are amazing.
Yes.
And if you look back now, the director, Juan Bikir Simón, was a very openly gay Spanish director.
Mm-hmm.
So, he must have been in his 50s when he made the movie. And it stars Edmund Purdom, who was like a heartthrob back in the day, but now he's like 55 with dyed black hair, starring in like bad Spanish horror movies. But there's such great characters. There's so many hot girls. But clearly, this guy, you can tell that the director has all these issues with women because he's growing up like in Spain in the, you know, in the 40s and 50s. And it's like a very, very Catholic society. So the chainsaw killer, like there's a jigsaw at the beginning with the crotch missing, and there's
yes.
a scene where the killer holds the chainsaw like a dick, like slowly walking in shadow. It's very funny to watch the movie in a strange meta way, thinking that this was made by a gay director and like whatever repressed anger he has against women.
And the final scene in that is amazing too.
Well, the final scene's amazing, and I watched that with Quentin when we were shooting Inglourious Basterds, and his friend Ada, who was incredibly smart, had a whole theory about that, you know, about the movie being about these discarded pieces of women, getting revenge. I don't know. I don't want to ruin it. It's great. It has one of the best, most shocking, amazing, and truly inexplicable last shots in horror movie history.
Yes,
I agree.
They came out on DVD about 5 or 6 years ago, or a re-release of it or something. I watched it again.
Yeah, Grindhouse.
And it Grindhouse. It does hold up, and that end shot, much like the original Sleepaway Camp, it's just like, what the hell is going on? It's crazy.
Sleepaway Camp is amazing. Sleepaway Camp is one of my favorite movies, slasher movies of the 80s. It's like, it's great. It's a great body count by the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
With the last 5 minutes, and then that last, I love those movies that can really pull off the last shot. Whereas in a film like April Fool's Day, I've tried to give it a chance, but I know it falls apart in the last 5 minutes, but it sort of doesn't in an unforgivable way. It makes you kind of not like the movie. You're like,
yeah, the last couple minutes of that just takes you right out of the game.
Twist, you're like, what?
Right.
It's just sort of like, oh, come on. It makes you, leaves a bad taste in your mouth. But then, like, Pieces and Sleepaway Camp, and certainly Saw did that. The first Saw 1 and 2.
Absolutely.
The end was so good, you're like, oh, anything else in the movie you could, you know, that you might have not liked or whatever, it's like all is forgiven because the twist got you.
Yes.
It's great when you really get got like that. I got to say, the first time I saw Blair Witch and Paranormal Activity, I was legitimately terrified.
I agree with you on both. I remember,
now you go back and watch them, they'll never have that. I'm almost jealous of people that watch them for the first time, but it's also like you've heard so much about them that I don't know how they could be scary because they've been overhyped to death.
Well, do you remember when Blair Witch first came out? Like, when it first came out, before all the pomp and circumstance, like, I remember reading about it online or in one of those, you know, upcoming preview movie magazines that people thought it was real. They were saying this is real footage culled from, you know, wherever, New England or whatever.
Yeah, nobody, you know, it's interesting. With Paranormal Activity, they didn't have the actors do any press until a week or two after the movie came out.
Oh, really?
Because people thought it was real. And then even with Last Exorcism, even though we didn't say it was real, we held back Ashley Bell. I did the first week of press, but it was actually a strategic move to let the cast go out the second week because it's just almost to give everybody the impression of they didn't know them. We didn't want people watching the movie going, oh, yeah, I saw her on that talk show. It's actually easier to get.
Right.
Everybody wanted to talk to her after seeing the movie. Anyway, she's an amazing actress. But it was it's part of the thing with those movies, with the docu-style movies, if you can keep the cast sort of unknown and hidden. But back, Blair Witch was the first movie that used the website to really promote it.
Mm.
People went on it, and it was just buried, the Haxan website, which is Haxan was the production company of those guys. And that's a great movie. It's a Danish film, directed by Benjamin Christensen from 1931, also called Witchcraft Through the Ages.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some really, really cool, bizarre, awesome, amazing imagery in that. If you love old, there are a lot of people that love old black and white silent movies, which obviously they move at a very different pace.
Yeah.
And they're in this, almost like you're in a sleepy trance watching, you know, it's a very different type of movie. But those films like Cabinet of Dr. Caligari,
mm-hmm.
Carl Dreher's Vampire, VAMCYR, is a really, you know, they go, it's so interesting because the cameras were so big and so heavy to move, they set up these really, really, really long, elaborate, very creepy, very haunting shots. And it's also fun to watch everyone from another time and how they dress and the food. And it actually gives it this otherworldly, it's so far away from our time now that it gives it this great, strange, otherworldly creepiness. I love whenever someone can scare me in black and white, like a racer head scares me, I'm always even like doubly impressed.
Well, a lot about those movies too is it wasn't what you saw, is what you didn't saw left it up to the theater of the imagination, right?
Yeah, I know. And that can work both ways. You know, sometimes Blair Witch does it really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
Then other times you go to see, I remember like, you go to see a slasher movie and the good stuff's cut out.
You're
like, I'm going for that. And it's interesting, like My Bloody Valentine, the original, is great, great, great Canadian horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's just amazing. Music by Paul Zaza, who did the music for Prom Night. And it's My Bloody Valentine, that original one, is a great slasher movie that keeps you guessing. But that was a movie, there was, I think, a violent Ronald Reagan assassination attempt happened, and people started blaming movies for violence. Because the guy he'd watched Taxi Driver crazy. Like,
right.
Somehow there's an assassin, this is how crazy it was. An assassination attempt on the president. Paramount says cut all the violence out of My Bloody Valentine. So there's a whole theme of the drill press, and that footage is lost.
It's gone forever.
Gone forever. The director, they can't find it. It got destroyed. The negative, the actual negative is gone. All the stuff. They've tried to look for it a number of times. No one's ever found it. But the original My Bloody Valentine is a fantastic holiday slasher movie. I also love Mother's Day.
That's a great one.
Direct, and if you talk to Lloyd Kaufman, he will tell you that his brother Charles is the true talent of the Kaufman family.
Also, his brother directed that.
Yeah, his brother, Charles Kaufman, and it was written by a playwright named Warren Light, who went on to write a lot of, like, you know, kind of Obie Award and Tony Award winning, that's just sort of nominated shows. Like, Warren Light was like a very, very interesting writer, wrote Dear God, like, went on to have a long writing career. And that movie was very much their comment on society. Like, Mother's, it's interesting how I did a screening of Mother's Day with Charles Kaufman. And I said, if you look at the way he photographs, it's got like a Boogie Nights feel to it. It's 1980, and they have like a California party that was shot in the back of Lloyd Kaufman's parents' house in Connecticut. But the way he introduces character, like one of them, the character is very, very tightly constricted and moved, and she's very dominated by her mother. The other one, she goes into her house, and a man kind of puts his mouth around her, and the focus is all on him, and she's in the background to symbolize that she's very controlled by men. And then the third one, the camera's moving very wild because this girl, there's a roller skate to indicate that this girl's wild and free. And I was like, Lloyd, you introduce character through camera movement. You have one that's very rigid and controlled, one that's very wild and crazy, and one that's completely like marginalized by men, which is what happens to the characters in the movies. And he actually had tears in his eyes. He goes, in 30 years, you're the only person that's ever noticed that. He's like, that's exactly what we did. If you realize that Mother's Day, and they made it for $150,000, Mother's Day and Friday the 13th, the original, were shot on the same lake across from each other.
Wow.
At the same time.
No kidding.
Summer. Yeah. Oh, it's great. So, like, they would go, like, the rap party, like, Mother's Day and Friday the 13th, like, all the bar at rap, they were all hanging out together, both crews. And but Susan Kaufman, Lloyd's sister, did the art direction of Mother's Day. They filmed fake TV commercials that are playing in every TV in the house. And it's really about these two people that, like, it's almost like the pop culture, all this garbage that's being pumped through pop culture, through television and commercials, it's overflowing. Like, they are the sewer of pop culture and kind of EST and these sort of cult therapy things that were happening. Like, when you watch the movie, and it's funny because I've heard Guillermo del Toro pontificate on Mother's Day, too. Like, it's obviously very dismissed as, like, a crazy slasher movie. But there was a lot of thought put into it. And I always respect the movies that do that with a $150,000 budget. There's nothing. And it's a really brutal movie. Like, there's a rape scene that's like where the mother's watching the kids rape her. And like, you look now and it's like, how the hell did they do it?
Oh, I know.
They got this actress, Beatrice Pons, who only shot for 8 days. Like, she plays, her credit is Rose Russ. All the actors, like Michael McCleary, takes the name Billy Ray McQuaid or Holden McGuire. Like, all the actors took fake names to avoid paying the union fees. But that's a movie that really, the Blu-ray came out, it really, really holds up. It's smart, it's well done, and that's a movie that's not going to scare you, but you can watch it over and over and over, and it still is like, it's great when just someone puts that kind of thought into it.
Sure.
But I also realized that Hostel 2, I totally structurally, without even realizing it, I completely structurally took Hostel 2 from Mother's Day. And there are these weird fades to red that I did in Cabin Fever. I forgot. I watched Mother's Day. Oh my God. I didn't realize that Hostel 2, you're following the girls, and then suddenly you switch and you follow the guys who are the ones that are going to be torturing them, but you really kind of like them. So it makes you conflicted because you don't want to see them do that to the girls because you like everybody.
Wow.
And that's what happens in Mother's Day. You're watching these three girls. They're going on this trip. And then at a certain point, the narrative shifts, and it's all about these two guys. And you're watching this mother and her demented kids, and she's yelling at her kids. And it's interesting how when you watch these things at 12 years old, you know, it's like the same obsessions that you have when you're a kid, like all the Guns N' Roses music, all the hockey, mm-hmm. all the wrestling. It finds its way into Fozzy. It finds its way into books.
Yeah.
It finds its way, you know, Bloodsucking Freaks, of course, with Ralph. It finds its way into, you know, yeah. your wrestling career. Like, all these little strange things, whether we intend them or not, you're like a sponge, and it just kind of keeps flowing through you.
What's your favorite Lloyd Kaufman movie, your favorite trauma movie?
You know, that first Toxic Avenger is, well, I mean, probably Mother's Day for sure, because that was a trauma production. But I was really into Squeeze Play. I don't know why, like, when I was a kid, I loved that movie. But the first Toxic Avenger, I just thought had the hot chicks. I loved the superhero. Class of Nukem High was one of my favorites. Toxic Stupid. But that first Toxic Avenger was the one that really got me.
Was Lloyd a little bit of an influence on you as a filmmaker in any way?
Lloyd was a huge influence. I mean, I did the audio commentary on Bloodsucking Freaks DVD for, I think, $15 in, quote, subway fare, because Lloyd couldn't even get the director, Joel Reed, to do it. And I was like, all I've basically done is study Bloodsucking Freaks. But I went through Yahoo People Finder. I mean, this was in, like, 1996, 97.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't just, there was no Facebook. You couldn't just track people down. And I found so many cast members and tracked them down at work and got them on the phone and just got these stories from, like, Niles McMaster, who plays the quarterback, and Dan Fossey, who then came to the screening of Cabin Fever, who plays the detective, who was working as an executive at Paramount, was totally mortified that I, you know, tracked him down to Bloodsucking Freaks.
So you just tracked him down and cold called them?
I called his office, like Dan Fossey's office. I was like, who is this? I was like, this is Eli Roth. I was like, Trauma Films. Like, wait, you can't say it's Dan Fossey. Like, you cannot connect. Like, do not say it's Dan Fossey. Don't say I work at Paramount. Don't say it plays Detective Tucci. And I go, well, you were really great. He goes, you know, I was doing my Columbo. I go, why was Detective Tucci reading Variety? He goes, it was ironic. We thought it was a satire. You know, we thought it was like, it was funny. Like, I thought I'd do, that's why. I was like, you look great in that trench coat. He goes, yeah, I was doing the Peter Falk. Like, he totally was. I complimented him. And then I saw him later. And he's like an Amy left parameter. He's an acting coach. And I was like, you were terrible. I was like, you terrified me on the phone for the first 10 minutes. He's laughing so hard. He goes, yeah, I was just giving you a hard time. Because I loved it. Because I listened to your commentary. It was great. It really brought up a lot of fun memories. So,
so overall, if you had to pick your top three favorite horror movies, could you even do that?
I mean, the ones that I go back to, it's weird how the favorite ones become like your pet. It doesn't make them the best horror movies. Your favorite movies, it's got to be John Carpenter's The Thing.
Right.
You know, the John Carpenter's The Thing, The Shining, maybe, God, I don't know. That third one is so hard. That's the one that rotates. Like, the two that are the constants, probably The Exorcist.
Wow.
The Exorcist just traumatized me as a kid. And I watch that movie now, and it's such a complex film. It's such a masterpiece. There's so many great. That whole opening sequence of Iraq is just so freaky and creepy and weird. And it's just, you know, here I am in Charleston, South Carolina, and I'm filming a show with Possession. I did my first kind of demon fight yesterday. And the whole time you're trying to not be conscious of The Exorcist. But once The Exorcist finds it, you're like, how can you? That's what Possession is to everybody. How can you not do it? And by the way, it's so fun to do that. So it's here I am shooting a Possession flick. Of course, it's got to be The Exorcist.
Well, that's one cool, like you said, you shot a Possession flick, you shot a jungle cannibal flick because you're so much into Deodato movies, and it's always cool when you can, like you mentioned earlier, all these influences that we had as kids, they come out in your professional career as an artist now.
Well, yeah, look at you. You know, you grew up on Appetite for Destruction and Killers, and now you have Fozzie blowing up and doing amazing. Like, that's, you know, you watch your favorite wrestlers, and now to some other kid, you're their favorite wrestler. And that's the most exciting thing, is that you're going, one day, I want to do this. I want to do my version of it. I want to get to do something in the tradition of what you love, but do your own, like, that,
do your own
spin on it.
That's right.
Like, nothing more satisfying. It's the best.
Well, Eli, I appreciate it. I know you got to get back to set, man, but I'm glad. It's always cool to talk to you. And next time we're in town together, we got to hook up and find some new J-horror movies or some new Fulci movies something.
I'm actually doing something on Vine. I'd love to plug that. I think you'll really enjoy. I'm doing a contest called 6 Second Scare. If you search the hashtag on Twitter or on Vine,
mm-hmm.
basically, I got the judges. I got Tarantino, Elijah Wood, Rob Lowe, Kid Cudi, and Vanessa Hudgens, and myself. All six of us are judging. It's, like, it's called 666, the 6 6 years. 6 seconds, six judges, there's six prizes, and the winner, whoever wins it, I'm going to develop an idea with them and this company, Davis Entertainment, that did Predator and the new Frankenstein.
It's amazing.
Yeah, but like the scares are amazing. Here's the thing. Anyone in the world can do it. 6 seconds, you can shoot it on your phone. You don't get extra points for it being, you know, expensive or not. It's just the most clever idea wins. We've got over 1,000 submissions, and some of them are so good. If you search the tags, I've been rewinding and retweeting them. If you look on hashtag 6 seconds scare, anyone can enter as many times as you want. It costs nothing. So we just wanted to do a contest that basically, if you're 15 years old and you have a phone and want to shoot something creepy in your house, Tarantino's going to see it. All the judges are watching them, and everybody's really impressed. So
and
we're going to announce winner on Halloween.
You sent me one just yesterday that was unbelievable, the people making out in the bed.
Yep.
That was that was incredible. I thought that was something that you had done.
No, but some kid in Argentina did that.
Oh, my gosh. It was amazing. It was amazing.
I'm telling you, dude, look up 6 seconds scare. They're really, really great. So that's, you know, the contest is open until Halloween, and anyone can enter as many times as they want.
All right.
It's something fun that, like, globally everyone could get into, and it's pretty unbelievable. Even people with no money, some 17-year-old girls in her house making some really, really creepy stuff. Awesome.
We'll check that out for sure, and anyone can enter. So, and Eli, like I said, man, one of my favorite people, and congratulations on all your success, and hope we get a chance to hang out face-to-face again soon.
Yeah, dude, let's do it. I'll see you soon, man.
All right, dude, take care. I'll buy you a pumpkin beer.
Cold pumpkin beer.
See you later.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
This is Talk is Jericho.
Here with me in the studio right now, one of the most important filmmakers of the last 40 years, Lloyd Kaufman, the creator of the Toxic Avenger and so many other amazing characters. How you doing, sir? It's good to have you here.
Well, thank you, Chris. And, of course, you are a Renaissance man worshipped in Tromaville by the Toxic Avenger, Sergeant Kabuki Man, NYPD, and many, many others.
Well, here is a funny story. I wrote about this in my second book. I know you write books, too. But the very first day I signed with the WWE, with Vince McMahon's company, I go to Stamford up in Connecticut. I have a meeting with Vince in his office at the Titan Towers, it's called. I go in there. I've never met him face to face. He's like, Chris Jericho, Vince McMahon, nice to meet you. The first thing he says, he opens his desk and he pulls out this script for Toxic Avenger 4, Citizen Toxie. And there's a part in there where Toxie, I guess he's going through time,
yes,
and ends up in the middle of a wrestling match. And for some reason, somehow, at some point, it was Chris Jericho in the match. He goes, look at this. You just got to the company and they already want you in the movies. And he threw that. I was like, oh my gosh. And then, of course, I never heard anything about it again. But that's the
magical trauma competence.
Yeah,
totally.
But that was my first meeting and conversation with Victor Man was about Toxic Avenger 4.
Wow.
So ever since then, I mean, Toxie and me have always.
Well, Citizen Toxie is the best one. That is the best of the four Toxies.
Well, I mean, what an iconic character. And we'll talk about the creation of the Toxic Avenger that everybody knows. But it's so great to have you here. You just got into Los Angeles from New York City. You've got your lovely wife with you here. Because the American Cinematheque giving you 40 years of Lloyd Kaufman, kind of a celebration of you and all the work that you've done.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how does that feel?
Well, you know, it's all they heard I was going to be on your podcast, Chris Jericho. And
they just stuck it together. They piggybacked
that's
them.
That's right. They did, indeed. And what can you say? The Museum of Modern Art, actually, in New York, premiered Return to Newcomb High Volume 1 in their Contenders series, which is, in their words, the best movies from around the world. And it had David Lynch's movie, the Coen brothers, Sofia Coppola, Woody Allen, and Lloyd Kaufman.
Lloyd Kaufman.
Sort of like Tiffany's next to a crack house. And
But isn't it interesting, though? I mean, after all these years, I mean, all the trials and tribulations you've been through with Troma, now you are, and you have been for a while to a certain segment, but like you said, the official critics, the people that are kind of like dealing with the biggest filmmakers in the world are now including you in their ranks. I mean, you're now finally, you know, you finally become accepted by the masses, almost.
Well, as Woody Allen says, success is 88% just sticking around. I'm the herpes of the movie industry. I'm not going away, Chris. Not going away.
Well, I mean,
away.
Lloyd, your journey to get to that place, I mean, so many movies that have left, a mark on people from Toxic Avenger, and you're talking about Return of Nukem High, which is another one, Class of Nukem High, now it's Return of Nukem High Volume 1, which is the sequel, and now playing theaters, and you're doing Q&As for that. People are showing up. You've become kind of like the official kind of figurehead for, I guess, I don't even know if it's B-movies, but able to make good movies on smaller budgets.
Kind of the underground, independent auteur cinema.
That's right. I mean, how did you start to do this? I mean, I know it's been 40 years now that you've had Troma. How did you get into the film business in the first place and be able to kind of perfect this model?
Well, I tried to wrestle, but I wasn't very good at that. So I had to go to Yale University, and I got roomed with a movie nut just by kismet. I was going to be a teacher or a social worker, mm-hmm. make the world a better place.
Right.
Teach people with hooks for hands how to finger paint, stuff like that. And but I got roomed with this movie nut who was the Yale Film Society boss. He was head of the Yale Film Society. I'd drift in to see movies, and I kept getting blown away. But holy cow, look at that movie by John Ford, Frank Capra, Stan Brakhage, who is the greatest, was the greatest living, he's dead now, but the greatest visual artist of my lifetime. And I just kept getting knocked out. And then finally, after acid, which I also loved, that's about all I learned at Yale, acid and Marvel Comics.
Which kind of go hand in hand.
Yep.
Especially from the
70s. I never read comic books, and the guy down the hall from me had Marvel Comics, and I searched out Stan Lee, and he and I have been buddies for 40 years.
Yeah, I was going to say, you guys are kind of
for more
the
than
same,
40, 50 years.
From the same area of the country and almost the same
we
age.
We wrote a he's 92.
Oh, is he really?
Mark. Now we are going to wrestle. I'm going to win. You've got a good voice, by the way.
Well, thank you very much.
I don't mean radio, but I mean singing, too.
Oh, thank you.
You are
thank
a Renaissance
you,
man.
No well, I mean, just it. The same as you, just kind of following the dream and not listening to any people that tell you can't do something. Because I'm sure when you started first wanting to get into filmmaking, a lot of people are like, oh, come on, Lloyd.
Exactly.
Give me a break.
Indeed. And they're still saying that. Just read the reviews. Although the New York Times gave Return to Nukem High Volume 1. Volume 2 we are still filming. But
okay,
volume
this
one,
Volume 1. Well, what was the first movie that you ever made?
The first movie I ever made was a 16-millimeter made shot with a Bolex, The Girl Who Returned, black and white. And Bolex doesn't allow you to do sync sound, so you have to lay the narration, music, and sound effects.
Oh.
It doesn't have a sync pulse. So I made a very boring movie. But we sent it. It was a feature-length film, and we sent it around to Harvard and the Ivy League mainly. It was kind of a novelty because it was a student-made feature movie in 1968.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned that no matter how bad a movie is, Chris, people will not ask for their money back for the most part. And I also had a poster that went around that they put up on campus, which had a non-male lying on her back. It was a
non-male.
It was about well, I'm very politically correct.
That's very
you,
well done.
As are you. And she's lying on her back with a big heaving
bosoms,
love pillows, in a small tight T-shirt.
Also politically correct.
A tight T-shirt had nothing to do with erotic. It had to do with athletics.
Mm.
But because she was exhausted and lying on the ground, it
breathing heavy.
Anyway, we had a pretty good crowd when it played at Yale, and
they did not ask for their money back. Which
no,
is
they
always
did not.
Plus.
They should have.
No,
but,
you.
But Michael Herz, who I met at Yale, we decided we wanted to start a studio where we could make movies with nobody telling us what to do. The auteur theory, the French auteur theory of filmmaking, where the director is the soul of the director guides the movies.
Mm-hmm.
And we hoped that if we established it, we could get we could empower other directors. And we've been able to, you know, the South Park guys' first movie.
Well, yes.
Cannibal the Musical.
That was pre-South Park as well. It was almost their first big break.
And the guy who wrote Tromeo and Juliet, which is going to be shown at the Cinematheque tomorrow night. Mm-hmm. James Gunn, he is currently directing and writing Guardians of the Galaxy. A big
wow.
Yeah.
Well, and there's a whole bunch of people that were kind of discovered. We talked about Matt Stone and Trey Parker, their first film. I mean, also Samuel Jackson.
He's in Def by Temptation. I didn't direct it, so you know it's good.
And that's
terrific.
Def, like, you know, like, yeah, yo, yo.
That's right.
Def,
yes.
Yo. Wow. Yeah. So he was, that was his first movie, was a trauma movie.
Yeah, and we were ahead of the curve, as we always are, movies of the future. Death by Temptation came out a little ahead of the black filmmaking movement.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, the video stores wouldn't take it because they were worried that those people would hang around their stores.
Really?
It did very well in movie theaters because if the theater has a problem, they just kick the print out and send it home. But with the videotapes, the stores had to, you know, they have to buy the videotapes.
Right.
And it's an investment. And there was still a tremendous amount of prejudice until Boys with the Hood came along. And then that was a big hit. And then
so you're talking about the mid-80s or so?
Yeah, really? Late 80s. Late
oh, okay,
80s.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah, shows you.
Do you know that Samuel Jackson actually is the leader in box office totals?
He's huge. Yeah.
See, there you go. He's got the most box office total ever. So, you know, there's hundreds of millions of dollars from the Matrix movies and the Star Wars movies. And, of course, what was it called? Def? Was the movie?
Def by Temptation.
Death by
Temptation.
And
the guy who directed it, James Bond III, wrote it, directed it. And it's a wonderful film. Najid, the music is terrific. Charles Huggins put all the music together. And his wife, Melba Moore, had a featured role. Kadeem Hardison from the TV show.
Oh, yeah. Different World.
Yep.
Okay, so what about Vincent D'Onofrio?
He's in the first Turn-On. He played a character called Lobotomy. He was interesting because he showed up as an actor person. We don't call extras extras.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's equal on a trauma set.
Good.
Nobody
right.
should be carrying anybody's suitcases. We're all...
Except for yours.
No. I don't even have a suitcase. I live in
plastic bag.
A refrigerator carton. Yeah, that's right.
You've got one of those sticks with a kerchief on the tied on it.
Exactly.
So he played Lobotomy.
Every day he'd show up as what you would call an extra.
Actor person.
He would always do something terrific. And so his part, we started giving him more stuff, and he ended up with a featured role called Lobotomy in the first Turn-On, 1983.
Wow.
It was right after the Toxic Avenger. No, it was before the Toxic Avenger. And now Vincent D'Onofrio acts, he's on those big TV shows acting as if he's had a lobotomy.
Private Pyle from Full Metal Jacket. Now,
that's true. Full Metal Jacket, that was great. He was great.
That's right. Now, here's another one, famous, and this is actually an Oscar-winning actor that started with Troma, Kevin Costner.
Well, he's in Sizzle Beach, USA. I did not direct that. That was another producer. We own the movie. It's a Troma movie.
Right.
And I think that it is Sizzle Beach, USA is probably Kevin Costner's best acting, for sure.
Could be.
I think it's generally agreed.
Sizzle Beach, what state is that in?
Sizzle Beach, USA. It's West Coast.
I'd like to go there on vacation sometime.
It's before silicone, so the...
Natural Sizzle
it's
Beach.
It's natural, yes.
Oh, very nice.
All natural.
So, I mean, we're talking about not only... Lloyd, you've kind of are the center of the entertainment universe when you really start digging down into your past. Not only did you start the careers of the South Park guys and Jackson and Costner and D'Onofrio, you actually went to Yale with Oliver Stone.
We grew up together. We met in second grade.
Really?
Yeah. And
wow.
Parents were very tight. He was writing, and then he went to Yale. I went to Yale.
Mm-hmm.
And he was writing. He was trying to be James Joyce.
Mm-hmm.
And I was movie nut. And he hung around he was writing a novel. And it was awful. Sucked. And then he hung around the movies. And then he started. He worked on Battle of Love's Return, the first movie I had in a movie theater.
Oh, okay.
And then
he worked on it as a
just
writer?
Helping out.
Just
and he's
general.
He's in it, too.
Oh.
He had a
he actually was an actor in it.
Well, whoever was available. My father's in it.
Hey, come here. Be in the
exactly.
movie. Right.
And then Sugar Cookies with Mary Warrenov and Lynn Lowry. He was the associate producer on that. And then he went off. Turned out he was a genius for movie making.
So Yale.
He got in through because I brought him in. I don't think he would have had that idea. He would have been still writing this crappy book.
Do you still talk to him?
No, he dropped me.
Will he take your calls?
He dropped me immediately.
You son of a bitch, Oliver Stone. If you're listening to this, you better pick up the phone and call your old pal Lloyd Kaufman.
Stop rewriting history.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. Stop making up lies about Jim Morrison's life. Okay, so and then also, I mean, I keep name dropping here. Huge. You're not saying a word because you're a very humble guy. George Bush, another guy that you went to school with in Yale.
W. Junior. He, freshman year, was running around campus looking for weapons of mass destruction. Bush, I never understood what that was all about, but someday we will discover.
I mean, so obviously you came from a very famed class. I mean, Stone, Bush, and Kaufman go together
just
for
the
history.
Fickle finger of fate.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Now, you know, like I said, I mean, I've known about you and known about your movies for years, and it sounds like I'm reading facts off a page, but I am because I did some research and found out all these amazing things I never knew about you. Also, that you worked on Rocky, the original Rocky Sylvester Stallone classic. You were
indeed.
Did you edit it or did you?
No.
What were you doing?
They didn't have. I had worked with John Avildsen on Cry Uncle, which is one of his early movies. It's a trauma release, Cry Uncle with Alan Garfield. It's terrific. Paul Sorvino's first movie. Then Avildsen got the gig to do Rocky, but the producers didn't have enough money to film it on location, which Avildsen and Stallone wanted.
Philly?
It's written for Philadelphia.
That's right, yeah.
So they hired us, a non-union group, to set it up and film it.
To do all the pre-production?
No, to shoot all the Philadelphia scenes. They used the Cry Uncle team, Avildsen's Cry Uncle team.
Wow.
And all non-union and for about 8 days. And all that stuff of running up the stairs.
Steps of the Spectrum.
All the great scenes. Imagine if Rocky didn't have those scenes.
That is the best scene. Jumping up and down on the steps with the people following
Absolutely.
Him. You filmed that.
I didn't. The Cry Uncle people did.
Right.
And I was the pre-production supervisor, which was basically line producer or production manager. And the Teamsters found us, I think, on the eighth day. And then the producers and everybody went back to L.A., but they already had all that stuff in it. I had to stay in New York, of course, and get my legs broken. But other than that...
You were the sacrificial lamb.
And the dailies, Michael Herz, my partner Michael Herz and his wife, were syncing up the dailies on our 50-year-old upright Moviola machines.
Wow.
And then sending them to Philadelphia for the stuff we were shooting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they were hearing, and they were like, what the heck is this? But my mother-in-law had read the script, had read Rocky, and she knew. She said, this will be the next Marty.
Really?
And boy, was she right.
Did you guys know it at the time? Or was it kind of a low-budget film?
Well, John Avildsen, I believed in. I met him on Joe, which is every film he's done is great. He's a great American director and in fact, we found my home movies of Rocky. I don't remember shooting them, but
that you filmed.
I filmed Super 8 or 8mm behind the scenes, and I've got Rocky running up the stairs and what camera we used.
Wow!
And then the Steadicam, which was the first time this. And Matt Mangiarides from Troma, who wanders around our basement, the Troma building basement at night. He found these 8mm films. So Avildsen cut them together. He edited them down, cut them together to about 8 minutes, and then he and I wrote a little script, a commentary script.
All right.
And you see Burgess Meredith, you see how we're wetting the streets, you kind of see how we made this movie. It's like we do a trauma movie today.
Yeah.
Avildsen had to do a driving scene. He has Sylvester Stallone actually driving the car, which you'd never do today. Avildsen's tied with ropes to the front of the car. Filming it while the car is moving, and we're all hanging onto it like
that's
like
amazing.
Those slapstick policemen, Keystone cops.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's on the new Rocky, the complete Rocky Blu-ray. There's an edition of all the Rockies, and it's on the stuff that Avildsen and I narrate. We
just happened to find it in your basement.
Unbelievable, yeah. And Avildsen edited. And then we did the commentary, he and I.
Wow.
And it's on that Blu-ray. That's pretty amazing.
That is amazing.
That's
yeah.
like finding footage like, from Gone with the Wind or
absolutely.
Something.
Absolutely. Right? I mean, Rocky's a legitimate American classic.
The Toxic Avenger is kind of a classic, but Rocky is the super...
It's on a different level.
Yeah, it's the Taj Mahal or the Sistine Chapel.
And even better was that you were actually in Rocky and you played the drunk.
I did. I did play the drunk, and I...
Method acting.
I was... Well, actually, I was very young, and I did get drunk just to try to...
Just to fit the spirit of it.
And I wasn't a very good drunk, and Avildsen showed me. He did it for me, how to be a drunk.
Oh, not to overemphasize or like...
Well, no, he actually... You know, kind of he acted it out the way I should do it, and he's a good actor.
Wasn't the scene like? Were you like in a back alley and Rocky walks past and gives you like a quarter?
What no, he it? I'm asleep in the gutter.
That's which, right.
That I am good at. I've broken up many times
sure,
in a
of
puddle
course.
Of my own vomit. And he Stallone picks me up out of the gutter, carries me into the bar, and sits me next to another bum.
And that was you.
That was I. And
see?
And the interior of that scene was shot in California.
Oh.
So I had to get out to California if I wanted to be in the rest of the scene.
For your part.
So I paid, you know, being a ham, I paid my way out to get those extra 3 seconds in the movie. By the way, I'm in Guardians of the Galaxy, James Gunn.
Really?
He did not drop me, unlike others.
So he still talks to you?
Oh, yeah. He's put me in Super, in Slither, and now Guardians of the Galaxy.
Does Stallone ever talk to you?
I don't think he would take my call, but he did set the Troma time. I was in Rocky V, and I gave him a Troma Times, and he lit it on fire. It's our little in-house newspaper.
Oh, wow.
So I think, he remembered me.
You've been in 2 of the 5 Rockies.
Well, I got cut out of, according to Avildsen, Stallone wanted me cut out.
Okay.
My acting was just too good.
Well,
but I'm
point.
In the credits. I'm in the credits.
Well, so you've been in the credits of 2 out of 5 Rocky movies.
Yeah,
that's more than Mr. T. Right? That's not bad. That's not bad.
That's a good point.
So, I mean, how did you start Troma? What was your concept of this new studio, and what was your kind of your mission statement when you started it?
The idea was to make movies that came from the heart that Michael Herz and I believed in, and the Paris, the Pascal Paris, the bet mm-hmm. was that we would keep the budget low. The compromise was we'd have to work on a low budget and learn how to get a lot of production value on screen, and we'd have to compete with Paramount and MGM mm-hmm. and all that. And
so you wanted to start out kind of as a major studio, but making kind of lower budget films.
We just wanted to have artistic freedom and not be bossed around. And I bought into the French auteur theory of filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
I speak French, so I had read at the Cahiers du Cinéma, which was the magazine of the Cinémathèque Française, which propounded, it was written by Godard and Melville and Chaperol, and they were journalists. This was in the late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And they hadn't made them, they were just getting into making movies, but they were writing about it, and they propounded the auteur theory of cinema, which I bought into.
Okay.
And then I took acid one night, and I decided that I would stay in New York and work for a tiny little private company, a little independent company, rather than I had another job offer in L.A. on The Owl and the Pussycat, starring
that was a big
Barbara
movie.
Streisand.
Yeah,
a big Columbia picture thing.
That's right.
But I chose the crappy little company in New York, and that's where I met John G. Avildsen, who at the time was finishing one of his little mm-hmm. movies, and that led to Joe, which was a huge hit.
Yeah, yeah.
Peter Boyle and Susan Sarandon.
Construction worker goes crazy or whatever it was. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
That's a great
That movie holds up very well. Written by Norman Wexler, who wrote Saturday Night Fever also.
Okay. So in the 70s, you're like, to me, the first Troma movie that I heard about, especially being, I think I was 14 at the time, was Toxic Avenger. Because I was a big a fan of horror movies, kind of B, C horror movies, and then everyone was talking about the Toxic Avenger. You got to see Toxic Avenger. Was that kind of the first really big movie that Troma did?
Well, we did a movie called Squeeze Play in 76 or so. It was after I worked on Rocky. It was mm-hmm. about a non-male softball team.
Non-male, politically
correct. We don't say woman. It has mm-hmm. the word man in it. We don't say girl. That's terrible, as you know. That's awful.
Don't say
Vince
girl.
McMahon would never
dame.
Say that.
You don't want to say dame?
Well, there is nothing like a dame. I think if Richard Rodgers and Hammerstein write that, it's probably acceptable.
Look at the gams on that dame.
Exactly. And Dame Philomena. course.
Dame Judith Dench.
There you are.
It's royal.
Flows trippingly off the tongue. We say gyno. Gyno American, gyno Australian. In fact, you might know some gyno wrestlers.
There are some gyno wrestlers.
Very politically correct.
You guys are adding slang to the American lexicon.
Well, we believe in the correctness. You can tell by our movies.
Absolutely. So Squeeze Play, you started that.
The theme was the all of our movies have political themes. This one was women's liberation. Mm-hmm. So the gynos want to start their own softball team because their husbands and significant others are all out on the weekends and they playing softball. And they, non-males, start their own softball team. And it's a raunchy. It came out a little ahead of the Porky's.
Yeah, because that was the big trend in the early 80s.
We got there ahead of time. We did Waitress. We did Squeeze Play, Waitress, and the Stuck on You, which was about palimony.
I remember those.
Yeah, Stuck on You, and then the first Turn-On. And then the majors started moving into our turf.
Right.
With movies like Porky's and
Screwballs and Hot Moves.
Even bigger ones, yeah.
Even Fast Times
but
were
they
so
were
high.
Not, and they were playing unfair because they had good actors and good scripts. And
That's not right.
So that's when we moved into Toxic Avenger.
Kind of doing the horror. We're going to talk about one of Lloyd's possibly greatest creation, Toxic Avenger, Toxie. And we're having an amazing conversation with one of the greatest filmmakers of the last 40 years. We'll be back with more Talk is Jericho. But first, we're going to check in with our sexy beast sponsors. And we'll be back with more Lloyd right after this.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hello! It's so good to see you! With my one good eye.
Welcome back to Talk is Jericho. I'm here with Lloyd Kaufman.
And those are great sponsors. They are the
right?
best. Let me tell you, they are
amazing.
I mean, Troma, all the fans of Troma and Toxic Avenger, they love those sponsors.
And I appreciate that. And that's every single one of them near and dear to our hearts. Segue for you. Just like Toxie, one of the greatest creations in film, a horror movie history. Tell us about how the whole nucleus of the Toxic Avenger
started.
Well,
first of all, I have an exclusive news item for you, Chris.
Exclusive?
It's very exclusive.
You're hearing it here first.
Yes, you're hearing it. This just came in. We're writing the Toxic Avenger Part 5, the Toxic Twins.
It's been a while since there was this will be number 5. It was 15 years ago that number 4
came out. By the way, Toxie did encounter a sumo wrestler in Japan on Toxic Avenger Part 2, Toxie Goes to Japan. He actually did have a match against
That's a sumo match.
Yeah,
okay.
Sumo.
Okay.
Sumo.
Well, let's talk about the Toxic Avenger. Is this a script that came across your desk, or did you say, we need to have a superhero that's been melted by radioactive nuclear waste?
First of all, we had to get out of the raunchy comedy, Animal House type stuff.
Yes, because the big studios were killing you.
But they were coming in, and we hadn't. There was no room left to really. It sucked up all the oxygen. So we thought, there was a headline in Variety. I think it was. It may not have been for one of those rags saying horror film is commercially dead. No more horror films make money. So, okay, Michael Herz and I, that's our Hitler. We're going to do that. Then my wife and I camp a lot. And we were camping, and there's all this detritus, McDonald's plates and stuff in the wilderness.
What's detritus?
Detritus,
garbage?
McDonald's. In those days, it wasn't biodegradable.
Oh, like styrofoam.
Yeah, exactly. And the environment. I used to read a lot of, I still do, offbeat newsletters from the underground. And they were talking about toxic waste dumps ticking away like time bombs all over the world. Children playing in dumps in Rio with pixie dust, which was radium from hospitals, X-ray machines just thrown away. So here I thought, well, this will be an interesting the environment. Make that the theme.
Yes.
This was, of course, before Al Gore invented the internet and I think stole the Nobel Peace Prize from the two scientists who probably should have had it.
That's right.
This was 1982, Chris. And then Frankenstein. I mean, I've written a James Gunn and I have written a book called All I Need to Know About Filmmaking. I learned from The Toxic Avenger, which is all about it. And it and so I could bore you for an hour. But Frankenstein, I always wanted the monster to live. Mm-hmm. Chaplin, Charlie Chaplin, City Lights with the blind gyno.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Toxie's significant other is oops, non-seeing. Sorry,
right.
Non-seeing gyno. Yeah. We're all politically correct.
Yes, and, thank you.
So there's all sorts of stuff that Preston Sturges he does a fond satire of American villages, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. The town of Tromerville was kind of loosely
based on that,
modeled on his stuff, and then slapstick, and so we combined. Toxie was a Cuisinart of the genre, and people hadn't gone in that way, so it was quite unique.
It's a pioneering film for sure.
No theater would play it. No theater would play it. And finally, one theater in Greenwich Village, owned by a French woman named Jackie Raynal, who was part of Warhol's group.
Circle, yeah.
And I had hung out with them when I was at Yale. I was a big admirer of Warhol and the group. And she played it in her theater, Bleecker Street Cinema. And the next
famous theater.
It was, Bleecker Street, she got that it was satire. She was French, so she got it.
Oh.
And she was not your typical exhibitor here. Mm-hmm. Who, most of them don't even go to movies.
Right.
So except for Lemley. They are the best. Lemley in L.A., Lemley are the best. They watch the movies, and they love independent movies.
Yeah.
And there was a line around the block at the Bleecker Street, and it went there for it just took off, and we ended up with about 2,000 screens playing The Toxic Avenger.
Yeah, it got that big.
It got huge. It blew up.
I didn't know that.
With no advertising.
Because I discovered it on video when it came out, so I didn't know that it was actually had such a theatrical release.
It also was the first kind of genre movie with horror, although ours is a comedy,
mm-hmm.
but it was the first movie of that ilk that went out and proved that horror could make a lot of money on home video.
Because like you said, it was horror but comedy. Very heavy slapstick, but in the over the top, you know, gore scenes and that sort of thing.
And Toxie's very romantic too.
Absolutely.
Stan Lee says, "Who I've written a script."
You are younger than Stan Lee. We've discovered, established that earlier.
Yes, please remember
yes,
that.
Much younger.
He looks younger. Damn
20, 30 years
he,
younger.
He looks much younger. Damn it! But he and I wrote a script called Night of the Witch, which we had optioned. It's never been made, but it gets every once in a while someone tries to make it.
It's in the works.
Well, I don't know if it's in the works. There is a guy in Finland now who's very, very serious about making it.
All right.
But in any event, he said that the Toxic Avenger was a little bit like Spider-Man, and clearly Spider-Man influenced Toxie.
Mm-hmm.
Stan says that in the same way that Spidey put a new face on the comic book hero, Toxie put a new face on the movie superhero, and that what makes him a hero is that he is not his superpowers, because Toxie only has a mop and he can jump. That's it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Maybe now he's going to wrestle at SuperCon, but he has worldly problems, Chris. Right? Mm-hmm. He's got to take care of his mother.
Yes.
He can't keep a job. He's got skin problems, and conquering the worldly problems is what makes Toxie
makes him more human.
Such a great superhero. Human hero. Sorry.
What was the budget on Toxic Avenger?
The original Toxie was $450,000.
Mm-hmm.
The budget for that, Return to Nukem High Volume 1, was the same exact number. So basically, with inflation, we're making movies for about 20% now
of
what we
used
to.
Right. Now, how about the design of the Toxic Avenger? Did you spend a lot of time on that, or did you have the money to even spend time on that?
Because
it's an iconic-looking
that's
character.
That's a great question, actually. We had a makeup person, a makeup gyno, named Jennifer Aspinall, and I would tell her I want Toxie to be oozing and disgusting and flesh hanging out, and she'd send back these sketches of this cute guy with very nice teeth. And finally
she's still thinking superhero. He's got to be a superhero, right?
And finally I couldn't we had to start shooting, and so I went with her her plans, and boy was she right. and she's now does Metropolitan Opera and Saturday Night Live, and
once again
she was right.
Another person who started with trauma that went on to
she's
big things.
Very respected. Yeah.
Did you think that the Toxic Avenger is going to take off the way that it did in such an iconic way?
It sounds arrogant, but every movie that Michael Herz and I have made, I really believe these are great movies.
Mm-hmm.
And in a fair world, did you see Crank by any chance, or Gamer, or Crank?
Yes, yeah, Crank. Yes, yeah, Crank. Yeah.
Neville Dean and Taylor are trauma fans, the two directors.
Okay,
and they say that in A Fair World, Poultrygeist, Night of the Chicken Dead, which I directed prior to Return to
another Dubai. Huge hit.
Well, it was not a huge hit.
I mean, it's well known for Troma. I shouldn't say huge hit, but a well known Troma movie.
Did have a lot of chicks. Yeah, poultry. See,
literally.
I can say chicks.
You can, because you're talking about fowl.
Chicken. Yeah, exactly.
Right. You're talking about farm animals, really.
That's, well, that's a
whole other movie that we're talking about.
That I don't talk about.
I don't want to talk about that.
They say in A Fair World, Poultrygeist, Terra Firma, Romeo and Juliet should be huge hits. They're good movies.
Yes.
And unfortunately, we are independent. The industry has become very consolidated. So the Rupert Murdochs of the world have these vertically integrated mega conglomerates, and they control the pathways to the public.
Mm-hmm.
And it is extremely difficult to get to the public. And luckily, Troma has a loyal fan base, small but very loyal and very aggressive.
Well, because people know what to expect when you see the Troma name on a film. I mean, you know, like I said, there's a certain vibe that Troma has that no other studio has. Like we said, it's horror-based, very over-the-top gore scenes, but funny, slapstick. We talked about Terra Firma. That's probably one of my favorite Troma movies, if not my favorite,
thank you.
With
thank
the
you.
Ridiculous character known as Popo.
Yes.
But I mean, there's just so many things in that movie that are just over-the-top, like just people getting splattered all over the place. And I mean, you know what you're going to get when you go see a Troma film. And that's kind of, I think, one of the reasons why, I mean, like you said, you've done great business amongst a smaller fan base, because that doesn't appeal to everybody.
Well, no.
Is it supposed to.
Well, I think it does appeal to a wide audience. The problem is we can't get to the wide audience.
From a distribution standpoint? Or?
Toxic Avenger, fourth Toxic Avenger. Cannibal the Musical, which is Trey Parker's movie, has never played on American television.
Wow.
Not even Crappy Cinema.
Wow, really?
Yes. We are economically blacklisted because we are not in league with the giant conglomerates. We're not... we're not in with the elite.
Yeah.
So our movies don't. The real profit source is TV.
Or right. Right. Especially nowadays.
And if you don't get on some kind of TV, which doesn't cost you anything to get on, right? It's just to give them a master.
Yeah.
You don't have to make 100,000 video DVDs.
Yeah. DVDs
or whatever. So we're excluded from that. We've never had a movie in Blockbuster. We have been economically blacklisted. It's only because Troma has this brand name appeal to our fan base and to people like you, Chris, that we're still around.
But why can't you get it on? Like, let's see, you mentioned like Cinemax 5 or Showtime. I mean, there's so
Ask
much.
Them. Ask them. They'd rather have crap made by Fox Searchlight or crap made by the vassals of the. No, it was their independent movies are come in through the vassals.
Uh-huh.
You know, the Sony Classics
or the
Fox Searchlights or whatever, you know.
How about, like, with the advent of forums like Netflix, let's say? Could you try and go through them?
The pattern is when the new technology comes in, they come to us with their hat in their hand. They say, oh, Troma, please, the studios won't deal with us. We have this great new thing called Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
Help us out. When we become rich and famous, we're loyal. We'll stay with you, and you'll grow with us.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, you know, Troma doesn't have a pot to pee in, so we okay, here you go. And then as soon as they become big, they don't take our calls, which is exactly what's going on with Netflix.
Wow.
They deal with – in order for our – we have a lot of movies on Netflix,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't talk to us.
They're just putting them on.
No, they took them from some big company. So we had to go through some kind of aggregator and then another company. By the time, if there's any money, which I don't think there is anyway,
wow,
Netflix
yeah,
never
yeah.
paid us anybody any real money, I don't think. There's nothing left. So it's a tough.
It's
world
amazing.
Out
you would
there.
Think that somebody. I mean, we're talking and we're making having
and
some fun.
By the way, may I predict? I just wrote an essay about net neutrality, the free, open, and democratic internet. The last democratic mm-hmm. medium is the internet.
Mm-hmm.
If Comcast and the gang get rid of net neutrality, you and I are in serious
it's
trouble.
It's becoming a monopoly for all these. Yeah,
but Netflix is supposed to be on the side of net neutrality. I guarantee you that they're going to make in fact, I think they already have. They'll make a sweetheart deal with the ISPs, with Comcast.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to turn on us. They're going to close the gate. They got in. They innovated. They got in, but they'll close the gate, make a sweetheart deal. So the innovators of the future, the Netflix of the future, mm-hmm. who are going to disrupt things and make life better for consumers, they won't be able to get in. And you and I, we'll be in a living under the highway.
Yeah.
We'll be taking bath salts. I already am, by the way.
Give me some, man. I mean, we're making just having some fun. But, you know, we're talking about all these people that came through the Troma doors and went on to big things. I mean, you're also talking about filmmakers like Eli Roth and guys like Quentin Tarantino that have taken Robert Rodriguez. They've taken
They're fans. Eli is in our movies. He's in some of them.
But that's what I mean. Wouldn't you think that, like, one of those guys would open some doors up to help you get into some of these places?
I think the industry is a cartel. It's very it's a few big conglomerates, and they control everything. And
so how do you you know, you're still making lots of movies?
We still make movies. Yes.
You still make movies, right?
Yeah.
So how do you get them out there then? If you're not getting them on to, we were talking about the cable stations or onto Netflix, is it still through old school DVD? Still through theatrical release? Are you how do you do that?
We do DVD. We do Blu-ray. The Blu-ray of Toxic Avenger is being made at this very minute.
Right. And Bloodsucking Freaks, which
Bloodsucking Freaks, up. Thanks to
one
Eli Roth.
Favorites.
And you, thank
one
you,
of my
Chris,
favorites.
For the amazing
Actually,
instruction.
I had a sidekick about 15 years ago when I was working for Ted Turner's WCW. His name was Ralphus. I totally got that name from Bloodsucking Freaks, the little midget, the crazy midget, looks like John Oates from Hall & Oates.
Can't say midget.
Oh, sorry, crazy height challenge.
Person, that's it. Stars is distributing Return to Nukem High.
Okay.
Return to Nukem High, Volume 1. They are
so that's good.
That. That's very good.
That's,
sure.
So
suddenly it's all over the place because they are a big, powerful company.
One of these days, probably like, you know, 30 years from now, the day after you pass away, someone's going to make a huge deal for Troma with Netflix or iTunes or something.
And
your grandkids are going to make millions.
But the people who work at Troma, they say that all the time. They say the minute Lloyd Kaufman gets hit by a bus, suddenly everyone will say, oh, he was so talented. He was an innovator. It's amazing that Peter Jackson wouldn't be here.
You're right. I mean, we were talking about, you mentioned your budget, $450,000 for Toxic Avenger back in 1985 and $450,000 for Return of Nukem High Volume 1, being the same amount of money, $450,000. How do you make a movie for $450,000 in this day and age? What are some of the Lloyd Kaufman tricks?
Well, our fans are very much taking part in the making of the movie. So for this movie, Return to Nukem High Volume 1, thanks to the New York State Film Commissioner and the Buffalo State Film Commissioner, we got a funeral home that was vacant in Niagara Falls, New York. And we had about 80 people sleeping on the floor and learning how to defecate in a paper bag. They came from all over the world on their own dime, from Iceland, from Japan, from France, from England, from California, all to make a movie they believed in with their hearts. They, for the most part, everyone got paid something, but nobody made any
money.
And the same with the actors. They were all people who were dedicated. They spent 3 months of their lives rehearsing and preparing. And it's fan-driven. So that saves us a lot of money.
Are you putting out like an open casting call?
We do, at
Facebook
the beginning.
Or something,
yeah.
Or whatever? Come and be a part of this legacy?
We do, yep. And when we announce something, because Troma is famous for being a stepping stone to stardom, to being a director of photography or a director, there's a line
makeup
around the
block. Makeup artists, all this stuff.
Yeah, they start with us. Yeah,
yeah.
Absolutely. And their first film, almost everybody on Return to Nukem High was their first film. And it's the best cast I've ever had. It was terrific. They're great. I mean, the New York Times gave this movie a good review.
Museum
of Modern Art, as I mentioned.
Right.
But it is very, very hard. And you can make movies for a lot less. I don't know how to do it because the stuff I do has thousands of people in it and relies on the practical effects.
Right.
But we produced a movie called Father's Day with some young Canadian directors. The entire budget was about $20,000.
Wow.
And it's good. It's terrific. It's wonderful. Played here at the New Art.
Oh, okay.
And again, we had it in we didn't have it in as many as Return to Nukem High, but it's a wonderful film. Those guys are the next Trey Parker and Matt Stone.
Well, I guess it gives people experience of being on set too as well if they're coming to work for you.
On the Return to Nukem High, experience.
Sure.
There are people got married. There are people getting married. There are people.
Babies are born.
I mean, really.
Yeah.
In fact, with the original class of Nukem High, Robert Pritchard and Jennifer Baptiste met on Toxic Avenger.
Mm-hmm.
They met on Toxic Avenger. He plays Bozo. She played Wanda. They got married. They've had children. And they've gotten divorced. It's a whole food chain. It's like an evolutionary chain.
We talked about trauma having some amazingly just disgusting effects and just a very innovative way of people meeting their demise. Do any of them stand out for you? Has there ever been one in your own movie that like grossed you out? You're like, oh, that's too far even for me.
No, because it's cartoon humor.
Very slapstick.
The full head crushing scene in the original Toxic Avenger has been talked about very intellectually. It's been talked about goofily. It's been talked about as horror, that people are horrified by it. But, I mean, basically, it's grand guignol. It's what the French did in the 1880s. You know, it's goofy kind of theatrical cartoon violence. It's Tom and Jerry, except that it's live action. You know, it's celluloid, not cartoony. Trey and Matt have said it, that South Park cartoons are heavily traumatized. The trauma's there, and you see it with the arm, Kenny's blood, rats eating his stuff. That's all.
Spurting blood.
It's just a cartoon. It's a little less obnoxious.
Is there a certain special effects team or person that you work with quite often?
Yes. People who are willing to suffer. They're always new people, and they're because we have no money. So people on Return to Nuke 'Em High were brilliant. In fact, one of them is directing a movie for us now called Mutant Blast. Fernando Ale. He made a movie. Can I say a bad word, or is there censor?
Nah, go for it. You're Lloyd Kaufman. You do what you want. I can't stop you.
Fernando made a film that my wife and I saw at the Spanish retrospective of Trauma in a festival. It was called Banana Motherfucker, and it was 20 minutes, and it is hilarious. It's absolutely brilliant. We both were roaring with laughter. Anyway, he worked on Return to Nuke 'Em High.
Okay.
Fernando, he's the nicest guy in the world, unbelievably talented. So he had he wrote a script, which we all agreed upon ahead of time, and he will be shooting that, called Mutant Blast.
Mutant Blast.
And the budget of that movie will be, I think, $25,000, and it was going to be crazy because it's not that big a risk.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
we can do anything we want.
Yes.
And he can get the production value that I cannot because he knows how to do the after effects and things.
What's two more questions for you, Lloyd.
Sure.
What's your favorite death in any one of your movies? Does one stand out for you?
Boy, I don't know. I remember my father, who was in Battle of Love's Return. There was a press conference, and they asked the newspaper, Times, asked him what was his favorite part of the movie. He said, well, I think my favorite part was when Lloyd gets killed, because I played the main part. That stands out.
How did you get killed in it?
A machine gun.
Okay.
Very simple. But I guess the toxic event, the full head crushing scene, the kid, I mean, it's a bicycle going one way, a car going the other. They hit. That is a hell of a stunt, because the physics of it the physics of two directions.
Sure. To actually film it, to make it happen, moving
objects in opposite directions that hit each other.
Yes,
that's an amazing stunt with a bicycle rolling over the top of the car, and then the kid getting his head crushed, and then the car rolling over his head a second time.
For the coup de grace.
I think that's pretty wild. Although Return to Nuke 'Em High, I don't want to be a spoiler, but the very first scene in Return to Nuke 'Em High is one of the craziest.
Has some good
deaths,
one of your finer
you'll ever see. Yes, involving
in a trauma movie,
involving and a kind of a worm.
Okay, well, of all the movies you've done, which is the one that stands out as your favorite? I know it's hard because they're all your children. Is there one that you go back to and think, this is the one I like?
I think the Return to Nuke 'Em High. I think when you see Volume 1 with Volume 2 as a unit, because it's a continuous story. I think that's going to be our real monumental movie. And Tarantino, came out of his suggestion
to do a sequel.
Well, it's not a sequel.
Or
it's a kind of a
continuation.
It's a revisiting, and it's instead of a boy and a girl love story, it's two. Oh,
it's a boy and a gyno.
Yikes.
See, now I'm into
nervous.
It now. I got it. You've taught me a few things.
I'm in such awe of you. I'm using the old word.
Lloyd, it's great to have you here. Congratulations on all the work you've done.
The movie. Right?
Citizen Toxie?
Wrestlers versus Zombies.
Oh, I've heard about that.
Great movie. That's Trauma. We just acquired it.
Trauma, too. Yeah. Pro Wrestlers versus Zombies.
Yeah.
Yes,
we've acquired the rights to it. We're working on that. We had nothing to do with making it.
Okay.
But we were lucky enough to get the rights, so we're going to work on that and see if we can get that into some
series.
Theaters.
You've always got stuff going on, Lloyd. It's been a pleasure to have you here. Big fan, and congratulations on all your work.
Well, the Ayatollah of Rock and Roll is indeed need a god in Tromaville, Chris. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to Lloyd Kaufman and Eli Roth. What a couple of great guys. And so many amazing movies and moments between the two of them. You can freak yourself out and sleep with the lights on with Hostel, or get grossed out at the over-the-top blood and gore in the Troma films, as Lloyd Kaufman mentioned, the crazy death scenes in Toxic Adventure and so many others. And don't forget to upload your entry to Eli Roth's 6-Second Scare Contest. Upload it to Vine or Twitter using the hashtag 6-Second Scare. Like Eli said himself, Rob Lowe, Elijah Wood, Vanessa Hudgens, Quentin Tarantino will be judging them, amongst others, and winners will be announced on Halloween night during Eli Roth's all-night horror marathon at Quentin Tarantino's new Beverly Cinema. Eli, such a smart guy. You got to check out some of these films, these short films, including mine, Chop Chop Son, on Vine. Go through my Vine account.
Wake up, Chop Chop Son! Finish your dinner, Chop Chop Son! Chop Chop Son!
Chop, chop, Dad!
Yeah, so that's an audio version of the Vine movie that we made called Chop, Chop, Son. It's on Chris Jericho on Vine, or you can probably find it on Twitter too. And make your own if you want to. Remember, you can enter all the way up until Halloween. The winner of the 6-Second Scare Contest gets a shot at developing an original idea with Eli and producers at Davis Entertainment. Go to fearthecrypt.com for more details. Such a great idea. And even if you're bored, hashtag 6-Second Scare. That's the number 6. I have found some amazing, amazing short horror films that scared the bejesus out of me. And I think you'll enjoy them as well. All right, if you want to support the show, remember the easiest way to do that is do your online shopping through my Amazon links. Very easy to find. Go to podcastone.com, click on the Keep Our Podcast Free banner at the top of the page, then click on Talk is Jericho. You see all three of my Amazon links in the UK, the USA, and Canada. Every time you do that, Amazon kicks back a little cash to the show so we can keep doing this for you for free for twice a week. No hidden fees or extra charges. You're just getting your shopping done and you're helping me out in the process. All right, last week I played Brides of Fire by Fozzy. You guys loved it so much, I thought I'd play it for you again. Kind of a creepy song about evil brides of fire. You know how the song came about. Crank it up from Do You Want to Start a War on Eek Week here. It's Halloween time and Brides of Fire.
Believe a bleed.
I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed Lloyd Kaufman and Eli Roth. We've got cryptozoologist Lauren Coleman. He's one of the top cryptozoologists in the world today. We're going to talk about lake monsters, Bigfoot, Mothman, New Jersey Devil, Chupacabra, giant snakes, so many crazy creatures that exist in this world or in the next. What are they? Lauren will help us decide. Plus, Tom Savini, another Talk is Jericho alumni, will be here to talk about his favorite movie death scenes, ones that he created when he was the king of special effects in the movies, and ones that he watched also. He's got some great Stephen King stories as well. All right, we're through. And in the meantime, and in between time, that's it. Another fun-filled edition, scream-filled edition of Talk is Jericho. We'll see you on Friday, and yeah, boy, eek week!
Don't leave now. We haven't made you for dinner yet.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.